The North State is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. It may be dangerous to be America's enemy, but to be America's friend is fatal. This is a quote that is often attributed to former National Security Advisor to U.S. President Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger. In truth, it was a word of caution about the U.S.'s relationship to the puppet government in South Vietnam in 1968. That if the new ruler met the fate as the last ruler, a coup instituted by the U.S., that this would be the lesson learned. But even though Kissinger used it in a cautionary way, it's far more true than he intended, at least at the time. After all, this is the same guy who said that Chile's issues were, quote, much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide for themselves, unquote. Now, I bet the last thing you expected was for an episode of The North State to open with me unironically quoting Henry Kissinger. But being a friend of the U.S., and now at least rhetorically its enemy, is exactly what Canada has been faced with lately.
Canada and the United States, that would really be something. You get rid of that artificially drawn line, and you take a look at what that looks like, and it would also be much better for national security. Don't forget, we basically protect Canada.
Now that he's president, Donald Trump has been poking Canada with a stick, calling Justin Trudeau Governor Trudeau, referring to the country as the 51st state, repeatedly discussing talk of annexation, even if he doesn't use that word. Whether or not he'll follow through is anyone's guess, but what's undeniable is that this rhetoric towards Canada, one of the U.S.'s closest allies, is unprecedented. Now, when the news media covers it, they talk about his erroneous claims of trade deficits. They discuss how Canadian politicians are planning to respond. They sometimes talk about how he has levied threats against Greenland and Panama. What they leave out, however, is how Canada and the U.S. have worked together to promote instability like this across the world. They leave out the context of Canadian foreign policy and alliance with the U.S. in opening up markets in other countries, like Trump wants to do, in Canada. So when the U.S. turns its gaze towards us, how has Canada let this happen? How can this country respond? Can we respond? Or, after years of faithful service, are we now stuck on the foot of the elephant next door? This is the North State. All right, so today we're going to be talking about everyone's favorite subject that has been going on in the Canadian news media. Trump is now officially President of the United States of America, and all Canadian news can seem to focus on, not just report on, they've done other things, but is his rhetoric towards Canada. And he made a very public appearance talking about it, which we're going to get into today. But for the purposes of this conversation, I wanted to talk to somebody who's very knowledgeable about the historical context of Canada's actions in the world, and of course their relationship with the USA. So today I have professor of political economy and author of Canada in the World, Settler Capitalism and the Colonial Imagination, Professor Tyler Shipley. Hello.
Hey Scott, thanks for having me.
No problem. I'm glad you could come on here. And just so we can start off, there's been a lot over the past month or two about what Trump has said and Canadian politicians' response, but where are you at with all the reporting going on?
I guess if I have a general sort of assessment of where things are at, the U.S. empire is in crisis, and it's probably in the beginning of its deepest, and ultimately existential crisis. And obviously the election of Trump is one manifestation of that, but it is also something that I think will accelerate the descent into crisis. And so I think, some of what we're going to talk about today in terms of these statements about annexing Canada, military intervention to take Greenland from Denmark, these things that, some of them are obviously bluster, but to the extent that some of them do end up manifesting as real actions, I think they will accelerate the decline, maybe not in the immediate moment, but they will accelerate the decline of the US empire. That is the moment that I think we are living. And from the perspective of Canada, that's our empire. Like, we're going where it goes, notwithstanding revolutionary movements in Canada that broke from, the status quo of Canadian politics. But assuming no revolutionary movement emerges in Canada, Canada will go essentially with the US, and they'll go down the same road. So it all speaks to, I think, a very sort of uncertain period of crisis that we have already entered and that is only, frankly, going to get worse.
I think that is important to touch on, and one of the things that is kind of like a specter in this election of Trump and this jingoism that's going on are the wars on terror. And specifically, what I have seen lacking in the context of at least the Canadian news media talking about it, like, so for example, I'll bring up this Global News piece I saw. So the headline is "Trump says Canada is a bad trade partner. Are his tariff threats justified?" Now, I think that's not exactly a great way to frame the headline, but in the article here, I'll just quote something here that kind of struck to me. So, quote, "The behemoth south of the border wants access to Canadian markets for all kinds of goods and services, namely telecoms and banking. And the US's actions in opening up markets is one of the huge reasons that Iraq was targeted." Now, do you have any comments on why this may be shifting to Canada specifically, or just, a little bit more additional context there?
Okay, so I think, first of all, your point about Iraq is well stated. The war on terror generally, but I would argue American foreign policy for over a century and a half has been, well, there are obviously other pieces, primarily driven by opening up markets for American capital, prying open every possible space where profits could be extracted. Profits that would flow back ideally to the United States. That has been the center of US foreign policy. That's all of the invasions in Latin America throughout the 1800s, all of the placing of dictatorships loyal to the US in Latin America in the 20th century. That is every intervention in post-colonial states in Africa and Asia. That's the Vietnam War. That's the war on terror. The war in Iraq specifically was all about claiming control of Iraqi resources, forcing open the market there, in a context where the previous Iraqi government had some protections built around it. Now, Canada has always done the exact same thing. Canada has been an active participant and supporter of the exact same project from its outset. Canadian capital has always essentially understood that it's a small faction, it's a small little group compared to the capitalists of the rest of the world. It can't flex the same kind of power. Canada can't as easily just go invade Iraq. So what Canadian capital has always had to do is operate under the umbrella of a larger imperial system. Of course, in the first instance, that's the British Empire, and then gradually through the early part of the 20th century, Canadian capital shifts its focus and its emphasis to supporting the American Empire, such that by the end of the Second World War, Canada is a full-fledged participant in what I think most people would call the project to globalize capital. The globalization project is fundamentally the project to make capitalism global and to make it a system that is geared back towards the US empire, that the US empire is at the center of it. And Canada's sort of way in to all of this was to say, we will support that project. We'll do everything we have to do to support the opening up of markets around the world to American capital. And we expect that that will therefore include Canadian capital. So I'm glad you brought up Iraq. It's a perfect example. The primary reason that Canada participated so actively in the invasion of Iraq, which it did, by the way, parentheses, to anyone who thinks Canada didn't participate in the war because for the first 3 to 4 weeks, Jean Chrétien pretended that we weren't. Canada was an active participant in the war in Iraq from start to finish. The reason was because as the occupation of Iraq began in late 2003, when the Americans, had fully conquered the country and seized control of all of its assets, they gave out contracts, primarily to US companies, but also to Canadian companies. As a reward for Canada's participation in the war, a company like Nortel gets the rights to rebuild Iraq's fiber optic network, which had been destroyed by the war. So this is like a really good example, a sort of a symbol of how Canada operated within the US empire. Participate, do political support, do intelligence support, do diplomatic support, do what you need to do to curry favor, maintain favor, work within the project of US imperialism so that Canadian capital can also gain the benefits from that. You know, you could say there's a bit of irony then that we're in a moment here where the US is sort of turning to Canada and saying, you need to open up, you need to liberalize your markets. And this isn't new. Like, this is a squabble, I should say, that Canada and the US have had for decades, more than decades, over specific industries, you know, where Canada has maintained certain protective measures around particular industries, and this has frustrated the Americans, but never to an extent that it threatened meaningfully the trade relationships that exist. And I guess we'll see if this is a moment where that changes.
I'm glad you brought up Canada's collaboration, if not outright invasion of Iraq. One point that I tend to bring up pretty regularly, and maybe you're aware of this, but there was a paper released, I think it was 2020, it's called Getting It Right, Canadian Intelligence Assessments on Iraq, 2002 to 2003. And it's essentially research that Canadian intelligence knew there was no WMD program and kept it silent. Now, I just want to hone in on one point of that, because this could be kind of sticky for people. Canada did not send soldiers, but they also didn't send soldiers in something like Vietnam. So what would you say to somebody who uses those examples as Canada going against the US or not, being defiant?
Respectfully, I would say those are both inaccurate. Canada did send troops. Canadian troops were all over Iraq. There are several units of the Canadian military that are fully, I don't know exactly what the military word is, but fully conjoined with the US military, units that operate together. They don't operate under the aegis of just one or the other. And in fact, one of them during the Iraq War was, again, I don't know the military term, but the guy in charge of this joint Canadian-US unit was Canadian. And they participated in the invasion of Iraq right from its beginning. Officially, the Canadian military didn't enter Iraq until a few months after the war started, because if you'll remember George Bush going on an aircraft carrier and saying mission accomplished, that was a few months into what we now know was like a 20-year occupation or 20-year war. And when mission accomplished was declared, Canada said, okay, the war is over. Now it's reconstruction. And Canada actively sent troops, publicly without any, without hiding that fact, to participate in the next 19 and a half years of the war in Iraq under the aegis of Reconstruction. Vietnam is the same thing. Canadians were active in every single level, militarily, in terms of in terms of intelligence, in terms of spying on North Vietnam. Producing the materials, the weapons, not just the weapons, but also things like the Green Berets, the literal Green Berets that were sold to U.S. Marines, or sold to the military to give to U.S. Marines. So so respectfully, I would say if a person thinks that Canada didn't participate in those two wars, they would just be wrong. And I think, this is something that it's funny, and this might tie back to what we want to talk about today a little bit, because at the time, certainly at the time of the Vietnam War, this wasn't really a secret. Like, this was pretty well known. There's a massive Maclean's magazine spread about all the different ways Canada's participating in the Vietnam War. From off the top of my head, I don't remember. I want to say maybe 1969, 70, something like that. So it was pretty well known at the time that Canada was an active participant. They had to pull Canadian flag stickers off the brothels in Vietnamese cities. this wasn't a secret. But it is funny that here we sit in 2025, and I think part of what we'll have to talk about in terms of all this Trump annexation talk is the Canadian identity that, to the extent it exists, is built around not being the United States. It's built around the idea, the premise, that there's something radically different about Canada, that we don't do things like Vietnam, that we don't do things like the war in Iraq, both of which we did. And we've done pretty much all the other things too. But it is interesting that we've built that identity. And I think that is going to be a factor, certainly, in how all of this stuff plays out in terms of Trump's claims, whether it's annexation or even just the tariff war. I think Canadian bourgeois nationalism may be a real force to contend with in 2025, much more so than it would have been, 30 or 50 years ago.
I'm glad you clarified that. I do want to bring you back to this Global News article just for a brief moment, because it contains two things that I think are very interesting. One is it corrects Trump, who says that there's a trade deficit of like $250 billion, and says actually it's closer to $40 billion. And it includes Kevin O'Leary as a supposedly neutral source. So when I read that in the headline, it very much is the same view that, well, you may disagree with how he wants to do it, but Trump wanting to open up markets for American goods in Canada is at least worthy of consideration. So when we talk about that, I want to talk about this treating of his rhetoric with Canada compared to Panama and Greenland.
I would certainly say this. Look, right off the top, when we make the comparison of Trump's rhetoric with Canada versus the rhetoric around, Panama and Greenland, I mean, there's obviously a level of chauvinism that he applies to those places that he holds back with respect to Canada. Sometimes with a particular brand of old white man racist, the racial hierarchies they construct can be incredibly complex. Like I used to talk a lot about Don Cherry and, that he's so racist that he's racist against, like, all the other white people. He's obviously racist against the non-white people, but even just not being an Anglo-Saxon means that you're somewhere below on the racial hierarchy that he constructs. I imagine that Trump has some version of that too, and maybe that's part of the chauvinism, because the Danes are certainly white. Of course, I think with respect to something like comparing the Greenland and the Canada discussion, I think there's a much more real possibility that Trump and the United States would take some kind of action to try to claim Greenland for a few reasons. I mean, the first reason, of course, is that it's mostly peopled by Indigenous people. It's mostly Indigenous people that live there. There wouldn't be any kind of displacement of a white settler population or upsetting of a white settler population the way there would be in a place like Canada. And I also think it would be infinitely more complicated to annex Canada. I think the Americans would view annexing Greenland sort of similarly to the way they viewed annexing Hawaii. I mean, Hawaii also had no, I mean, in no way was it contiguous with any part of the U.S. landmass. Not that that itself isn't problematic, but Hawaii was a series of islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. There was no, at the time, there was no, they had no problem annexing Hawaii. So I think they probably would view Greenland in a similar way. They would see it as a dispute between the U.S. and Denmark, with little regard for people who actually live in Greenland. And so I think in some ways that the rhetoric is more aggressive because I think it is actually a more realistic possibility. Whereas I think in my gut, all bets are off when you've got a loose cannon in charge of a fading empire. But I don't think realistically we're very close to an attempt at annexation of Canada. Like, I really don't think that's anywhere, anywhere close. So, I think the rhetoric also reflects that it's further away. The rhetoric on Greenland is stronger because it is probably more likely of the two.
You talked a little bit about this bourgeois nationalism of Canadians, and I want to draw that into focus specifically with how conservative politicians have addressed these comments and, the tariff threats. Doug Ford in Ontario is very much playing up the Canada not for sale hat and that whole, well, I stand for Ontarians and nonsense that it's been reported he's doing to kind of drum up support for an election. But then on the other side, you have probably the most prominent example, Danielle Smith, Premier of Alberta, going to the inauguration, meeting with Trump. And you have this weird division of defiant and conciliatory approaches. And it's interesting to see that play out. What do you think the roots of that are, and what do you think the actual effect of this will be, whether or not he annexes Canada?
Yeah, it is weird. In a way, it's the greatest gift that the Liberal Party of Canada could have ever received at this moment. Like, look, I think probably most people agree that as of 2 weeks ago, the Liberals were cooked and Pierre Poilievre was going to be the next Prime Minister. Like, I don't think that was in a ton of doubt. I don't think there's a lot of people that would have disagreed with that. What has happened, of course, is that since all of this stuff with Trump has come up, Trump has given the Liberals their campaign. Like Trump has given the Liberals something that they can actually use to win back some favor that they have lost. And as you point out, the Conservatives are divided on this. Look, take all of this with a grain of salt, but roughly speaking, this is how I would explain the kind of ideological map right now with respect to all of this. Liberalism is the ideology of capitalism. Like, I'm sure we agree. Liberalism is pure capitalist ideology. Liberalism is about free markets, free trade, extracting profits from the land, from people, and creating a regulatory regime that protects capital in every possible way. That's liberalism. That's what the Liberal Party of Canada does, and that's what they've always done. And they've always done that by working with, as I say, the British Empire and later, especially the American Empire. So the question is, what is conservatism then exactly? Like, what distinguishes conservatism as an ideology? And there's not much. Like, in terms of real substantive political economic issues, there's not much. Most of what distinguishes conservatism is vibes. It's reactionary vibes. It's like we're gonna be racist, and you can't stop us. Whereas the liberals will obviously move through different moments and try to reflect back a kind of false anti-racism, a false anti-sexism, a false tolerance and whatever, and multiculturalism and so on, whereas the conservatives will eschew those things. But in terms of the actual political economy of Canada, there isn't a ton of difference, except insofar as the Liberal Party of Canada is the party of the banks. I mean, you mentioned that that Global article specified banks and telecoms as industries that could be targeted or where the US would try to push its way in. Well, banks and telecoms, that's two industries that are, that's the liberals. That's their bread and butter. That's their finance. Like, that's their stuff. I mean, shit, the Liberal Party of Canada, liberal prime ministers were invading and flexing their military might in Latin America 100 years ago on behalf of Canadian banks, on behalf of Canadian finance. So the Canadian finance could dominate Cuba. There were more Canadian banks in Cuba than any other nation at the turn of the century. Telecoms companies were massive. Canadian telecoms dominated Brazil, dominated El Salvador. As a matter of fact, there was a revolution in El Salvador in the 1930s that specifically targeted Canadian energy companies. And Canada sent troops to help shut it down. So the Liberal Party has always been the party of those factions of capital that are Canadian, and where they are trying to protect the interests of specific Canadian companies, Canadian factions of capital. The Conservatives are, their economic base tends to be in different industries. Oil and gas in Alberta is the obvious example of this, right? And so there is a section of the Canadian right, the Canadian Business Council, sections of the oil and gas industry that would favor annexation at some level. They would convince themselves that full regulatory harmonization between Canada and the US would be positive, would be good for their industry. Now, they already own the capital, they already own the access to the oil and gas, like that's their shit. They own the refineries, they own the pipelines. And so they feel they would be in a good position, a better position with annexation. Now, I don't know that they're correct. In fact, I would argue that they're probably wrong. That probably in the big picture, as always, the liberals are the better managers of the capitalist economy. The liberals understand better how a capitalist economy works and what would be good for Canadian capital. And so when the liberals oppose, harmonization of the regulatory frameworks, when liberals say, no, we don't want competition in telecoms, we're pretty happy letting Rogers and Bell run the show here. From the standpoint of Canadian capital, of which Rogers and Bell represent a huge faction of it, that's good. Like, that's a win from the perspective of Canadian money. So, to the extent that there is this split between the liberals and conservatives on what to do about Trump's rhetoric, I think it comes out of that. It comes out of the fact that the liberals have always been the party of big Canadian capital, and the conservatives are the party of smaller factions or different factions of Canadian capital, that think they might do better if the border was eliminated. That's my best guess. I mean, to a certain extent, I don't want to overstate my expertise on some of these pieces, but that's my read on it. And I do think where it leaves the conservatives is just a terrible place, because now they have to choose between what they think they want, which is harmonization and close relations with the US, elimination of the border, all of the vibes of Trump, I mean, that's what they're trying to build. That's what they're cooking, right? They've got a big fucking cauldron, and they're cooking up Trump vibes as much as they can. They're whipping that shit up. They got the convoy. They got all these things. So they want to be with Trump on this. But they're also in this incredibly strange position now where Trump is threatening them. They can't even imagine that they would ever be the one threatened by Trump, and they don't know how to respond. So, yeah, you got Danielle Smith going out there kissing his ass, which frankly probably doesn't play that well to her base. You got Doug Ford over here making a big thing about I'm going to stand up to him. But like, I got to think that drives a wedge between some factions of the Canadian right, because obviously some of them really like Trump and they don't want to fight with him. So look, I just think this has handed the Liberals, just like Christmas came late and this was their Christmas gift, and all the Liberals have to do is sort of stand firm with respect to the tariff stuff, stand firm with respect to annexation, and they probably win a lot of votes back. They probably win a lot of voters back, which, what a strange time.
I definitely want to bring it back to the news coverage at some point. Like, a lot of this discussion is about what the news is not covering, and I think that's valuable as well. But you touched on something there, especially with conservatives, where they're in this strange position where, they're with Trump, but now Trump is threatening them. And I think it's very representative of Canada, how Canada has operated in the world, aligned with the US, like at least since World War II. And now they are being targeted rhetorically, and there's a trade war looming. And there's this shock that we're included in it. Do you think this was foreseeable, and do you think that the way that the Canadian political system works could account for that, like seeing far ahead? Like, do you think they could have prepared for this, and was it foreseeable in the first place?
At some level, it's all foreseeable in the sense that I think if you have any sense, any acumen at all, you know that the American Empire is falling apart. It has been for a while. Like, this isn't new. If you're seriously trying to assess what it is to live in a time of a declining empire that has a huge military, like, it's going to be chaotic. It's going to be a mess. And obviously, the election of Trump the first time around was a reflection of the sort of the chaotic moment. The thing to remember when we talk about the election of Trump is Trump is elected for a range of different reasons, right? And a lot of them are his presentation of being anti-establishment, which is fake, of course, but to the extent that he presents himself as that. But it's a reflection of chaos, because a smart right-wing person in the United States would understand that the Democrats are the perfect institution to run US capitalism, just as the Liberals are in Canada, frankly. They are the perfect institution. Biden, and the shell of Biden and the people around the shell of Biden ran the US empire as well as it could be run. I mean, notwithstanding that it's in crisis and there are contradictions that they can't contain. But they ran it as well as they could. There's no guarantee that Trump can run the US imperial machine as well. In fact, there's a very good chance that he runs it less well, runs it far more chaotically. So it's a self-defeating choice. And sure, there's a lot of it comes out of just, the chaos that the declining US empire has already created. The fact that people are being bankrupt because they can't afford medical bills. I mean, that's a country in chaos. That's a place in chaos. And obviously, for those people to be voting for Trump, you can sit here like a pretentious asshole and say, well, they made the wrong decision, didn't they? But I don't want to do that. Like, I mean, I think there's a million reasons why people make political choices that undermine their own interests. And a lot of Americans do that. A lot of Canadians do that all the time. It's an empire in crisis. It's the center of the machine is falling apart. So could Canada have anticipated that? Yeah, I mean, obviously. But I think they do. I think the people who run the Canadian state are very aware that the American empire is fragile and in many ways teetering on the brink of a kind of collapse. I just don't think they have any options. The only serious option, if you, and I'm trying to, and I'm sort of trying to think this through from the perspective of Canadian capital, which I don't usually do because I'm not Canadian capital. I don't have any. Give me some. I don't have any. But if I did, and if I was part of that class that is capital, they just have all of it. You need an alternative. Like you need something else. You moved from under the umbrella of the British to under the umbrella of the Americans, and you have to, at some level, always be kind of looking around and saying, okay, where is it going next? If the American Empire is falling, where is it going next? And how do we get ahead of this and ensure that we have some kind of smooth transition? Where it's headed next is obviously China. I don't think there's any ambiguity about that. That's the next center of capital. But I think where there is ambiguity is what happens between now and that moment where people look around in the, what is it, the 2060s, the 2080s, I don't know, where people look around and say, oh yes, we live under the age of the Chinese Empire. Like, do we even get that far? Does a nuclear war happen first? What does the American Empire do as it falls apart? What is, to the extent that the British Empire was able to kind of decline in a way where it maintained a very obviously powerful position within the system, can the US Empire do the same thing as capitalism shifts to be centered on China? I don't know. And I certainly don't trust the politics that are emanating from the United States that it will happen in a kind of managed way. So, yeah, of course, everyone in Canada should understand that we are attached to that horse and that there isn't even a realistic path to transitioning Canadian capital into a relationship with Chinese capital that it could protect itself. Like, that's not even really meaningfully on the table. Like, infrastructurally, logistically, politically, diplomatically, like these just like this is, militarily, our militaries are totally, totally interlinked. By choice, Canada made the choice to integrate itself militarily, but now that you've made the choice, you're kind of stuck with it. Of course, they could have anticipated, and they probably did anticipate this kind of thing, but I don't know that they have a lot they can do about it per se.
What I got from your answer is that Canada is Starscream, and we're just looking for our next Megatron.
Nice.
Thank you. So I'm glad you brought that up because I think the will isn't there, but also geographically, if Canada were to align more with China, I think at this point it would be, not to make a pun, but a red flag. So I'm glad you brought that up. I do want to pivot a little bit more back to the news coverage. And one of the things that I have kind of noticed in just going through some articles is that whether or not annexation really hits what how everyone is kind of, I wouldn't say fear mongering, but it's the topic of the day. He keeps talking about it like economic force for Canada. It seems as though it's working. Because what I've seen reported is that Canada has contemplated doing the exact same types of tariffs back to the US, but they've delayed it by a month. So if Trump starts it on February 1st, like he says he's going to, then we're going to wait until March 1st or even April, I think I saw. And then recently I saw it reported that the defense minister for Canada, Bill Blair, has accelerated the plan to hit 2% GDP NATO spending to 2027. That's by 5 years. And while these things are reported, it's not reported in a way where Trump makes threat, Trump gets something out of it. So can you talk about how this is working out, maybe materially, but also how news media is obscuring that a little bit, if you feel comfortable commenting on that second part?
Look, you're probably better placed than me to talk about the way that the coverage plays out. I mean, the news media in Canada is a shamble. It's just mostly a bunch of rich kids that
To
operate.
quote you, give me Canadian capital.
Exactly. So yeah, media coverage, I mean, at some level, I'm sure it's inane as hell and probably misses the point half the time because it's too stupid and half the time because it's too ideological. In terms of sort of materially, like what to expect and what how this is all going to play out, I mean, yeah, I think there is an aspect of Trump makes a threat and Trump gets something. And that may be the piece of this where Trump does have some political acumen. He does understand that Canada needs the United States. And he does understand at some level that if he makes these threats, he is liable to get something out of it. And I suspect my honest take on the tariff war stuff is I don't think we're going to see tariffs, and certainly not 25% tariffs, and certainly not across the board in the way that he's made it sound. I think that it is a threat, and it is a threat that is aimed at probably some very particular, specific things that the US wants from Canada. There is likely going to be a renegotiation of, I forget the acronym now, but used to be NAFTA, the Free Trade Agreement between Canada, the US, and Mexico. There's obviously pieces there that Trump wants to get and thinks that he needs to, sort of put this massive threat on the table in order to get it. Obviously, yeah, I think you may have mentioned the NATO thing. There is this issue that Trump wants Canada to spend more and contribute more on some of the whether it's NATO or other joint military projects, which I think he'll get. Like, I think he will get some of these things. And that will be a Canadian effort to avoid the trade war because it will harm both. Like, it's kind of like, I don't know if this metaphor works, but it's kind of like you're dealing with a sort of a crazed, violent, person, and you're trying to. It's like if we get in a fight, I'm gonna hurt you. You're gonna hurt me. You're probably gonna hurt me more, but I'm gonna hurt you too. Like, we both don't win here, and so maybe you try to make some concessions, to try to distract this violent person away from you. And I think that will be the liberal approach. I think they will try to make some quiet concessions, around things like NATO spending or, elements of the renegotiation of the trade agreement in order to avoid what would be a profoundly self-defeating trade war. Self-defeating for both sides. Like neither side benefits from engaging in a tariff war right now. Neither side of capital, again, to be clear. Perhaps some would argue that all of this chaos plays to the advantage of people trying to build revolutionary struggles against the Canadian or US state. In times of crisis and chaos, possibilities open up for people to organize against the systems that are taking us into this kind of crisis. All of this nonsense, is rooted in liberal capitalism. It's rooted in the economic system of capitalism. The insatiable need of capitalists to find profits, even when no profits seem to be presenting themselves, and the state apparatuses in places like Canada and the US, whose existence is premised on doing everything it can to find those profits and provide those profits and protect those profits. And when you create a system like that, it generates great wealth for periods of time for the rich. And it creates temporary periods of stability for the middle and working classes, but ultimately it creates instability and chaos, and it always has. So we're entering another of those periods, and there's likely to be a lot of chaotic and, in many cases, bad outcomes. But I can only hope that we of the left take advantage of these kind of cracks in the machine, the absurdities that come through in these moments, to say, like, it doesn't have to be done this way. These don't have to be the kinds of states we live in. We can live in a different kind of state that doesn't prioritize the needs of capital, that where policy decisions and party differences aren't determined by which faction of capital do you represent? Which group of the rich do you want to side with? Do you want to be with the oil and gas guys or with the bank and finance guys? I don't want to be with either of them. So maybe we find this moment, we find some way in this moment to rebuild that possibility and rebuild the struggle for something like that.
Boy, I wish I could say something more cogent and impactful than that. You really touched on what we can do in this moment broadly to, push back on something like this because it's representative of something else. But I do want to get your a little bit, we'll go back to this because you mentioned that this was the best thing possible for the Liberals, and I'm not entirely convinced that it will be enough to save them electorally. So materially, what will be the difference between a Liberal prime minister dealing with Trump and a conservative one? And I'm sure you're going to say this too. I don't think that means we shouldn't organize and shouldn't do things like this, but it is a very tangible difference.
I don't know. I don't know what difference it is. I am famously not a partisan. I don't believe that the Canadian state is radically different, whether it's governed by the Liberals or conservatives. And maybe that's partly a function of the work I do, because the work I do is always historically focused. I'm always drawing comparisons across different time periods. And so, I look at different eras in Canadian governance and Canadian policy, and I don't see, as Canadian policy shifts, I never see it being related to the party in power. I always see it being related to changes in the capitalist political economy. So whether it's the welfare state era from the end of the Second World War until, roughly the 1980s, that's the period of big government spending, this wasn't its only motivation, but to raise the floor for the working class, primarily so that working class people could still afford to purchase things from the ruling class. But nevertheless, like that kind of consensus in Canadian policy cut across both parties. Both parties did it. Neoliberalism in the 1980s, when that all shifts, and when those things start getting cut, and taxes start getting cut, and it's much more of a fend for yourself, plebs, kind of approach. That's both parties. Both parties do that. The difference in the middle of the 2020s between a conservative and liberal Canadian government with respect to Trump, I don't know. There will be obviously some difference. I don't mean to completely poo-poo the whole thing. I think it's more complicated in some ways for a conservative government for the reasons we discussed earlier. I think for a conservative government, it becomes, Trump's our best friend. How do we be best friends with Trump while at the same time, not losing face among a Canadian electorate that for the last 50 years has been fed a pretty consistent stream of Canadian nationalism? I mean, this is one thing we haven't talked about, actually. If this conversation was happening 50 years ago, it would probably be a lot different. And there probably would be a lot more openness, actually, across the Canadian electorate for annexation. Around the time of Confederation of Canada is partly motivated by the fact that there's a large section of the settler population that wants to just annex with the U.S. And the U.S. is openly considering just essentially taking Canada, too. So throughout Canada's history, there was, I would say, lukewarm support for a kind of Canadian nationalism, a distinct Canadian from the U.S. or from Britain, for that matter. But in the 19, I'm going to say 70s. I'm going to put it in the 70s. I mean, different people might locate it elsewhere. But in the 1970s, there is a concerted push by the state. Pierre Trudeau's government is actually, really instrumental in this. The Pierre Trudeau government really starts a process of building a Canadian nationalism, a bourgeois Canadian nationalism, an identity that is distinct. And I remember in school, going to school in the 90s, and I mean, so much of, like, a ton of my education involved talking about Canada and talking about what is Canada, what is Canadian identity, having these classroom discussions about what makes us different, whether it's peacekeeping, and don't get me started on what a sham that legacy is, but using the idea of peacekeeping as a way of saying we are not the Americans, we are different, right? That's all of Canadian identity is. That's all that exists to carve out of this settler population. The only thing you can do if you're trying to build an identity here is to say you're not the United States. And so that's what essentially the Canadian ruling class did. And it's kind of middle class, cultural architects created an identity that is based on not being the United States, and protecting the things that make us unique, like hockey. And so, the most important thing to a lot of Canadians is that we beat the Americans in hockey. That's had like 50 or 60 years now to marinate. And there's, a huge chunk of the Canadian population now that just grew up in it. I basically grew up in it. And, if I hadn't sort of become a left-wing radical, I would just probably have, I'd be fully immersed in the idea of a great Canada, a good Canada that strives to incorporate immigrants in a tolerant and inclusive way, that tries to build a, what did we used to call it, a cultural mosaic, as opposed to the US melting pot. Oh, in the US, they force everyone to be the same, but here in Canada, we let everyone experience their own. I mean, it was all bullshit. Every single word of it is and was bullshit, but it created a national narrative and a sense of national identity. Pull in a few bits of ephemera from TV commercials in the 70s and 80s and 90s. Oh, the Heritage Minutes. Oh, the Hinterland Who's Who. Mr. Dress Up. The old Hockey Night in Canada song. You pull a few of these meaningless bits of cultural ephemera together, and you have a bunch of idiots build their identity around it. I mean, it's absolutely asinine, like all nationalisms, and in fact, more asinine than most. But it worked. Like, it worked. So if you're a conservative politician, how are you going to cozy up to a guy who's talking about making Canada the 51st state? That's going to be very uncomfortable because most conservative voters love Canada, right? All those convoy trucks, what did they have? Maple leaves, right? Red maple leaves, red flag decals of the Canadian flag. They love Canada. The convoy loves Canada. They're all about saving Canada from the libs. So, I mean, my best answer to your question is, like, what's the difference between a conservative prime minister or a liberal prime minister dealing with Trump? I think it's far more complicated for a conservative prime minister, assuming this rhetoric continues, which it might not. Like, that's another possibility. Another possibility is that this is a wave of Trump doing Trump things to try to gain some concessions around a couple of particular issues, after which he chills out, right? And maybe the election of a conservative government later this year is the moment that allows him to save face, Trump, that is, to save face, chill out, and back off the annexation talk, right? So in that case, okay, then it isn't that complicated for the conservatives. But I certainly think, looking at it from this moment at least, whoever ends up being the liberal leader, they've given that person just like a ready-made political platform that will resonate with so many people. Because there's so many people in Canada who don't like Trump, who don't like the United States, or at least are lukewarm on the United States, and who love Canada. So, the Liberals are perfectly positioned for that. And they'll be in a position where they can essentially blame the Conservatives for cozying up too much, because of things like Danielle Smith and her trips to the US right now. So, I don't know. That's my best guess. I don't claim to be a, an expert on that particular piece, but that's my read.
No, I appreciate it. I didn't necessarily want you to do punditry, but having this history of understanding how conservative governments and liberal governments have operated in the world was very valuable. Tyler Shipley, thank you so much for coming on the North State and talking about this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. I appreciate it too. I hope I didn't rant too hard.
Thank you for listening to The North State. This episode was written, produced, edited, and hosted by myself, Scott Martin. Links to further reading in the description. Follow me on Blue Sky. Just search for yukotscott.com. Intro music is Vigilante by Crossdog. Artwork is by Zoe at Studio Bonjour High. I'll talk to you soon.